we've been trying to follow the concept of emuna. The last 5 weeks we've tried to discuss some of the approaches that are essential to arriving at an understanding of what we mean by the word emuna. We said that what we don't mean is faith. That what it's translated as is faith or belief, which is not what we mean. What we mean is knowledge. And we discussed together, that from a Jewish point of view, spiritual knowledge is not something that one accepts blindly. Right? There's no such thing in Judaism. There is a certain kind of blindness that has to be looked at also, but the heart of the subject is that we strive to have knowledge of something. Can I see? So we said that this subject is really what's called knowledge. Now, what we did was we said that we'd approach it intellectually. That means we were trying to work out together how one gets an insight at that knowledge. But before we could see what the knowledge is, we said we have to see what the approach is. In other words, we said that the hiddenness of emuna is that you can experience rationally that there must be something that transcends the rational. I mean, if you examine the physical world objectively enough, you can arrive at the conclusion that there must be a root that transcends the physical, but you can't know what that is. Remember? Anybody? And therefore, it's valid to take a rational approach, intellectual approach, because at least it can get one aimed in the right direction. What the knowledge is, we'll never have any idea about this approach, but at least you'll see that it's a valid direction, that there must be something. Once you know that there's something that transcends what you can understand, then it's a meaningful exercise to start searching and trying to understand in a transcendent mode what that knowledge, what that wisdom is. And therefore, we examine the pathway that takes one there. We looked at the concept of having doubts and how one can resolve them, what are the logical ways to deal with doubts. We looked at the paradoxes in doubt, that a person's not afraid of doing anything wrong, although you should be, where that takes us. We looked at scientific approaches to the world. We traced the heritage from Sinai and tried to examine whether that's a logical pathway, whether it stands up to objective examination. We looked at things from those angles. But we said that the essential level of knowledge is an inner wisdom that transcends all that discussion. That's a knowledge that one can have that isn't subject to words. And that's what we now have to look at. It's an exhausting subject to discuss because it's a subject that lives in a realm where, by definition, there aren't any words. Right? So you follow the problem. Right? We're going to try and discuss a subject that, by definition, breaks down when you try and put it into words. That's the nature of this subject. We're talking about a mystical, transcendent experience and knowledge which, when put into words, collapses. Right? That's the definition of the subject. So, from the start, it's almost impossible to begin. But since it's essential, we have to do our best to try. We discussed the subject together about a year ago. Those who were here on that occasion, you should hear a new depth in it. I'm sure you will. That's the most important subject that there is. But there's no more important subject I can think of than the root of emuna, because that's what makes you who you are. Everything else is just a mechanical way of going about getting what you want. But who you really are, what you really want, and what you really know so deeply that you can't even begin to put it into words, there's nothing more important than that. That is God consciousness. So it's worth trying very hard, with the inadequate and clumsy words that we have, to try and get to this understanding, even though the definition will tell us that it's impossible to do. So let's try it together. To try and get to something that can't be put in words, you'll realize immediately that the only way to get there is to discover that you actually know it already. Right? In other words, if it can't ever be put across to you in words, then I'm certainly not going to be able to put it across to you or to me. We're studying the subject together. No one has a complete understanding of the subject. But if it can't be put into words, no words are going to give it to you. If you don't have it, you'll never have it. Now, do you either have it or you don't. If you have this inner knowledge that's called Das, Das means Dat. Dat means knowledge that's so intimate that it's a connection of what you know with yourself. That's why Das means marriage. It means the intimate side of marriage. It means knowledge and it means the intimacy of marriage. Exactly the same thing. Because it's a knowledge that bonds with you so intensely that it's exactly the same as what the marriage experience is supposed to be and what it's supposed to teach you. That's what to know means, right? In the biblical sense. It means to really know something intimately, that two things become one. That two people become one, or that the knowledge and I become one thing. The mystics say that if you know something with inner knowledge, then if it turns out not to be true, you die. Again, if you know something with inner knowledge, it has to be so real that if it would turn out not to be true, you wouldn't exist. Because you become one with that thing. So, the pathway here is this. The pathway is to try and talk about it together till we get to a stage where you realize that you actually knew it all along. Some people know it already. Some people who are very in touch with their own basic personality and haven't thought about things too much. When you think about things too much, you spoil everything. In this area, when you start rationalizing, you ruin everything. Because when you think in words. And as soon as you put the subject into words, you lose it completely. This is a subject you have to know without thinking about it. Huh? And one of the levels you have to get to before anything else. You have to know about Hashem and about what it means in the world and what you want before you even start thinking about it. Because for sure, as soon as you start thinking about it, you lose it. As soon as you start thinking about what Hashem is and what transcendent experience is in the world, as soon as you start thinking about it, you lose it immediately. But that's part of the definition. It's not because you're a failure. The subject is that one. The only way to know it is because you choose it intrinsically, because it's what you are and it's what you want. But without thinking about it. The rational pathway that we discussed up to now only takes you to the verge. But stepping into that field has to be with an absolute certainty, because it's what you are. So what you are, it's what you want. And what you want is what you are. But only if you choose that actively for no other reason than that it's you, then you'll never have it. That means, you have to hear clearly what we're saying. What we're saying is this. One, if you don't know it already, no one will ever give it to you. Because the words can't give it to you. So the only way the words can possibly help is to bump you into realizing that you actually knew it already. But that's the only way the words can work. It's like trying to give someone a skill. Have you ever had the experience of trying to convey a knack to somebody, like a sport or some other skill? There's no way you can convey it to them. No amount of telling and demonstrating and showing pictures and diagrams will never give it to them. The only way you can ever get them there is by talking about it so much and so exhaustively that one day they get it by accident. One day you get them so close, are you with me? One day you get them so close that they actually get it by accident. And once they experience it, they realize that they have it and it's part of them, and then they can't understand what you were talking about for the last 3 years. But the words fall away. But it's so obvious. That's what it is. This is a subject that you have to be bumped into until you fall in. When you fall in, you realize you've always been there. But no one will give it to you if you're not prepared to fall in. And the only way you could fall in if you're not there already is to want to be that for no reason at all. Again, that's the ultimate paradox of spiritual growth. Is that you have to want it for no other reason than that you want it. And you can't get there through any pathway. Understand well. That means if you want emunah, if you want to live in the spiritual world, if you want to know what it means to experience something that's more than the physical, you have to know about it before you begin. You have to choose it, because it's what this amazing thing. I'll give you one application of this idea that connects it with what we said before we try and feel out what the subject is. You remember before, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we said that there's a tremendous paradox in the intellectual world that deals with spirituality. I'm not going to go through all the details, I'll just mention it briefly for the benefit of those who weren't here. We said that there's a tremendous paradox that when a person does something that's wrong, he doesn't feel shame and he doesn't feel fear. And that's illogical. Because any rational human being should at least accept the possibility that there's a spiritual world and that there's punishment for what you're doing wrong. It's at least possible. Anybody who tells you that it's not possible is either lying or is an idiot. He's a fool. Right? Because nobody can be sure that there's no life after this, that there's no punishment, that there's no reward. Nobody can be sure about that. Even if you're a very, very cynical skeptic. But it's at least possible. And we said that when you do something that has the possibility of danger, the natural pathway in the world is to be terrified. Is that correct? We gave the example of somebody, if you have to walk from the front gate to the front door of somebody's house who might just have a vicious dog that tears people apart,
Would you do it?
Let's say you have to visit a friend in a certain suburb, and you see in the newspaper that there's a house in that suburb that has a dog that tears people apart limb from limb. Okay? Now, there are many houses. There are thousands of houses over there. And there's absolutely no reason why it should be that house that you're going to visit for the first time. But you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't do it. And if you do, you walk up that pathway in utter abject terror. Because the possibility of danger impresses, yeah, we discussed this, the possibility of danger imposes itself so much on the natural human mind that it swells itself to proportions of certainty. That's the way it is. Is that correct? If I tell you to walk through a certain door and I tell you that there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that behind that door awaits a gruesome torture, 1 in 1,000 aren't you? Well, you wouldn't do it for anything. And if you're honest about it, you probably wouldn't do it for 1 in 10,000 chance, and probably not for 1 in 1,000,000. Be honest. Ask yourself. What odds would you need? Ask yourself. What odds would you need? And even if I told you that 999 of those doors have got happiness for the rest of your life, but one of them's got a gruesome torture, would you walk through that door? Huh? 9 out of 10? Definitely not. 1 out of 1,000? Not me. 1 in 1,000,000? Probably not. Huh? Which means that the possibility of danger is enough to terrify you. Now, why doesn't that work in the world? Why doesn't it work that the possibility of danger, the possibility that there's going to be a hideous torture? You know what it says about people in the next world? You know what suffering it talks about? I'm sorry to love those people who don't like this kind of talk again. But it says terrible things. I'm not going to go through it again for those who are too sensitive. But it says terrible things. Now, it's possible, right? So how come you weren't afraid? But it doesn't make sense. You do an avay, right? You break Shabbos. You eat something you shouldn't eat. You say a word that's unkind about somebody. You know what the punishment is in the next world for saying one unkind word about someone? Even if it's true? The unspeakable punishment. If you understood it, you'd probably destroy your telephone. and yet, you say things about people. You engage in activities that are wrong, that you know they're not allowed, and you don't feel any fear. You follow. It's illogical. It's illogical. Now, we said, we spoke about it, and we said, explained, and so Solanta said that it's a special action that Hashem has done. He's created us without this fear, without even the fear of the possibility, because otherwise you wouldn't have free choice. That's what we said. But let's take it one step further this evening, just to link it to what we're trying to discuss now. In terms of what we're setting up now, the understanding is as follows. What's meaningful to you is only what's part of your life. Only what's part of what's called chai, that means what's part of your essence, your intrinsic existence, is meaningful to you and your experience. You know what a vicious dog is. Now, you can picture what gruesome torture is in this world. You've got some way of relating to that experience. But something that transcends this experience, something that's not part of life, something that's in another world, is not part of your being. And therefore, the mechanism, the reason that you can't get in touch with it, that you can't feel fear, is because it's not part of what's called life. The next question is, how do you get there? And how is it that we saw people, at least until the last generation, who had that? Right? We saw people in the last generation who walked around with what's called the fear of heaven. The fear, Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, there were people who had that. Right? In this generation, it's almost entirely non-existent. Almost entirely, if at all. But at least up to the last generation, and for all the rest of Jewish history, definitely we had it. This is the first generation in the history of the world that's completely had that. Completely ownerless, no logic at all, no level at all. But until Rabbi Shaul Salanta himself, who said this word, who said this idea that I'm explaining, it's well known that in his generation there were people who used to walk around the day before Yom Kippur trembling with fear. Sweating and trembling with fear. Now you can't fake that. Rabbi Shaul himself one year had to get up and speak about Yom Kippur. He had to raise the people to an awareness of what Yom Kippur is. He got up on the bimah in the shul in Vilna, he said the word Yom Kippur and he passed out. It passed out in a panic of fear. Just from considering what Yom Kippur was, and that was him. Now, how did somebody get a feeling like that? How did he get? The answer is this. You need it to become part of your life. And the only way it can become part of what your essence is if you choose it. And you have to choose it with your essence. And the choice with your essence has to be for no other reason than that's what you are. That's the paradox. And that's the boundary. That's the guardian of the gate of getting into the spiritual world. That's why there's no way in. The only way in is to pick yourself up by your own bootstraps and throw yourself in. If you wait for someone to take you by the hand, not only won't they do it for you, no one, but it can't be done. That means a person wants to know that you wait until someone proves it to you. I want you to prove it to me. Huh? If Hashem is really existent, let him show his face. Let him prove it to me. No, I want to prove. I want to see. I'm not going to invest my life in something that I don't know. I don't have a proof for. Not available. It's not accessible. Not available. It just can't be done that way. Ah, we spoke for 5 weeks about the rational approach. Because the rational approach has to take a person to the verge. It has to take you to the edge. The rational approach has to take you to the point where you know that beyond there is something. But to cross the verge, you can't do rationally. To avoid getting there rationally is foolish. You can't leap into something that you've no idea about. That's not greatness, that's not immunity, that's foolishness. And you might well leap into the wrong thing. And you argue with somebody who's connected to some cult, or some anti-spiritual system, right? Or some negative spiritual system. What are you going to argue with? He's also made a leap of faith for no other reason. Torah doesn't make any more sense than his. Of course you have to go the logical route. You have to examine Jewish history like we did. You have to look at the world objectively. You have to go through that path. But when it finally brings you to the realization that the next step is a hechra, that means the next step is obligatory, but to take that next step, that's where they drop you. That's where they leave you. That's where the thoughts and the intellect and the words, they leave you alone. And you have to make that leap. We tried to explain once before that was the pathway of Abraham Avinu, Abraham. He knew he had to go. Hashem personally told him. And yet he's still regarded as a man of the greatest faith because he went. It's not knowing that you have to go that's the problem. Even when you know you have to go, that's when the problem begins. If doing it, even though you know it's right, that's where the problem begins. Making the leap. If you're brought to the edge of a cliff, and you have an absolute assurance that you won't come to any harm, that's where Abraham was standing. Hashem said to him, I want you to leap off into the unknown. I want you to take yourself and burn yourself alive. You'll be thrown into a fire. You'll burn yourself to ash. That's what he said. I know you're up over Ether. I'm ashes. I want you to burn yourself into ashes, and then you'll be born again and you'll know. Now, he had Hashem assuring you. So you think to yourself, well, if Hashem told me, I'll also do it. Is that so? If Hashem appeared to you tonight, think about it. If Hashem personally appeared to you in any form you wish, whatever it would take to convince you, and told you that I would like you to wake up early tomorrow morning, and I'd like you to walk to the edge of a cliff, 5,000 feet high above the rocks below, and I want you to step off and you'll be fine, you'll do that tomorrow morning? If Hashem himself told you, how do you feel when you stand on the edge and you're about to jump? That's immoral. You know it's right. You know it's a myth. That's not the problem. To leap without knowing is foolishness. That's suicide. You hear the problem? That's immoral. To make that step, that you do blind. That's where the blindness of immoral comes in. That's the word. Now, to cross that border, you have to move into the world of inner knowledge. The tool that crosses that border, the transition from here to there, is a tool called inner knowledge. That's a tool called us. That's a tool called the force that connects you with what's there and meets in the middle. That's what Das is. Huh? You know what you are, what's there you don't know, but there's a mystical ability to connect two opposites, two impossible things together. That's called Das. You can never put it into words, because if you could, it would never take you there. It would be part of what brings you to the brink. You follow me? And yet it has to be accessible. So there's a special gift in the mind. There's a special place in the mind. It's not only Jewish, this, by the way, it's universal. The Jewish version is a special version of it. It has a special flavor, a special taste. But it's a universal human experience at rock bottom. There's a special ability that the mind has that's able to bring you through the transition. And that's what we want to try and discuss, what's in the time that's available to us this evening. This quality, this knowledge called us, makes you human. That this is not icing on the top. If you don't have this, you don't have anything. The Gemara says, the Dabe Kulabe. The Lo Dabe Mabe. That's very harsh words. He who has this has everything. He who has not this thing, what does he have? Very harsh words. That means Chazal say that if you don't have this, you don't exist. You have nothing. You have nothing at all. There's an even sharper statement in Chazal that says that Mi She'en Boi Das, listen to this. Somebody who doesn't have that, who doesn't have inner wisdom, asur l'rachem alav. It's forbidden to have mercy on such a person. Can you imagine such a statement? Could you ever imagine hearing that in a Torah statement? That somebody who doesn't have that, it's forbidden to have mercy on such a person. You know what that means. I'm not saying there's a practical application that you have to go out and start doing. If you think there's a practical application that you have to go and stamp out people like that, then you definitely don't have that. But it's trying to show you the dagger, the level of what this thing called das is. One of the great Balaamis of the last generation said, that's a real rahmanis. Somebody that you're not allowed to have pity on, he really needs pity. that somebody that is forbidden to pity, that's the Rahman. That's the real Rahman, whether he really needs it. Now, so let's try and understand what this subject's all about, even though we don't have the words to say it. Let's try. Again, what we're trying to do, we're trying to get to a place where you recognize that you actually know this already, and you don't need what I'm saying. You don't need the discussion. As soon as you realize that you know it already, you don't need the discussion. Now, da'as is, the definition's useless again, but I'll tell you, it's that which you know because you know it. Not for any other reason. It's the core of what you are and what you know. It's what you know because it's part of you and because you know it. You asked to explain it, you couldn't explain it. If anyone asked you to prove it, you certainly couldn't prove it. But it's worth more than life, right? It's the fact of life, it's the fact that you are alive, it's everything that life is, it's much more than what life is. It's everything that you know about everything that you can't possibly begin to put into words. But it's at least as real as you. And you know it, you have that knowledge. All you have to do to get in touch with it is to want it. Because Da'as is rotten. The core, the germ, the seed, the genes of what Da'as is, right? If you want to go to the top of this thing that's called Da'as, the top of it is called desire. All you have to have is a genuine desire to have it, and you have it immediately. And it says, Ein dover oine bitna rotten. Nothing stands in the way of desire. Again, nothing stands in the way of desire. If you want it, then you have it for free. But you have to want it for no other reason than that you want it. If you want it for any ulterior reason, you don't have it at all. What you have is a false version of the Das that takes you in the wrong direction. You have to get to such a purity. You have to want it for the pure act of wanting it. That's a pure meditational act where you empty yourself out of all ego. And you want this thing only because you want it. And you couldn't tell anybody why you want it. And if you could, it wouldn't be the right thing. Let's try and explore it together. It's an embarrassing subject to talk about because it's so obvious. It's so many words about something that is so obvious that when you twig onto what's being discussed, it's embarrassing that a person has to spend a lot of time talking about such a subject. But unfortunately, this is a generation where a lot of people don't have it. Fortunately, a lot of people still do. Still do have basic class, especially women. It's a special talent that women have, right? That is a gift of having a weakness. The weaker a person is, in effort to intellectualize, the stronger they have doubt. The mystics say that that's why women have a tremendous ability to connect. Women have a very strong ability to bond. Men have a tremendous ability to divide. The male mind, again, you sometimes find this quality in women and that quality in men. Again, it doesn't work. You may be a man with a more of a female build, right, in the mind. But in general, women manifest the female side in general. And male men, if you are made in Southern California, it's the opposite, I don't know. But still, in most places, women manifest what's female, and men manifest what's male. Women usually manifest a very strong ability to bond, and men manifest, and by the way, that's one of the reasons that women are not allowed to be witnesses in certain matters in Jewish law. It's not because they're not intellectually competent. There are many women walking around a lot more brainy than most men, can assure you. And if that were the criteria, the halacha should administer an IQ test. But nothing to do with intellect. And women, by the way, not only more intelligent, often more practical also. But nothing to do with that. The reason that a woman is not allowed to be a witness is that she so intimately bonds with her experience that she finds it hard to be objective, and that's her beauty. You follow? As a doctor, I can tell you, anybody's experienced this as a doctor in any field of life. If a patient comes in with a child, if it's a man, and he starts telling you his child fell and he did this and that and he was bleeding and stuff, and then he tells you the story. The woman begins to tell you she's crying. And she's actually experiencing it all over again. She's so bonded with her experience, and that's her beauty. We don't want to take that away from a woman. So women have what's called da'as of chibur. That means the da'as of being able to connect. Men, unfortunately in many ways, they have the ability to divide, to be able to. That's, of course, why women don't drink Havdalah wine. When you make Havdalah is the effort that divides between one mode and another. When Shabbos goes out and the week begins, it's a very strong moment of division. And it's a moment that men try and strengthen. And wine is a very strong force that strengthens this in the neshama. And that's why it's a very bad thing for women to drink Havdalah wine. Because we don't want to strengthen that divisive ability. Women want to strengthen the ability to bond. Now, let's use the following methods to approach the subject. One of the greats of this century who expressed it in as close as you can to putting it in words was Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler puts it like this. he says that you have two modes in your mind. Now, this is the core of the subject. Okay, what we're going to say now is the core of the idea. If you could master this idea, then you have enough to work on for many, many weeks. And as you experience every experience in life for the next weeks and months, it will only clarify this understanding. But it's a new way to think about the world that you may not have come across before. It's the essence of Torah thinking, and it will clarify many, many things in the world that were confusing before. That's a wonderful gift to have this piece of knowledge. He said the following thing. The mind is split into two minds. The mind has a mode that looks outward, and it has a mode that looks inward. He called it Hamabat HaChitzoni, which means the eye, E-Y-E, that looks out. Mabat means like a view. An eye that looks out, and a Mabat HaPnimi, an eye that looks in. Those are the two modes. Now, the inner one is what we're talking about tonight. The Da'at is the mode that looks inward. The outer eye, right, is exactly the opposite. And fortunately, that one you can talk about. That one is definitely amenable to being put in words, and it's easy. It can be defined and put into words perfectly. Because it's exactly the opposite of the inner eye. And a beautiful access to the subject is because we can't speak about the inner one, but we can speak about the outer one perfectly. So what we do is, we speak about the outer one in detail until we thoroughly understand what it is. And then you just use the mirror of your own power of abstraction to flick it back into the exact opposite. Right? And that ability to flick back into is a natural gift. You do it all the time. You do it all the time. You have to use the same. When you look at a human being, again, mentioned it many times, when you look at a person, you find that you naturally use that ability. When you look at a human being, you're looking only at a physical piece of tissue. Right? You're looking at a lump of biological material. Nothing more than that. In fact, it's probably less than that. Because it's a lump of biological material that's lowly, it's smelly, it contains excrement. It's a very, very low being compared to what a human being really is understood to be. And yet, when you look at a person, you don't think about that. When you look at somebody that you have a meaningful relationship with, what happens is, although all you ever experience is the piece of steak that they walk around in, but as you experience that, it throws you immediately into your switch of abstraction, and you immediately apprehend a human being. It's a remarkable thing. You have to focus on how you do that. You take it for granted and you don't think about it. But it's the tool, it's the central tool that takes a person into the spiritual world. When a person, again, we'll go through it again, I've said many times, but you can't begin to approach this subject without this idea. When a person takes something that you need and they pick it up and they give it to you, the right way to understand that subject, that action, is simply a piece of tissue made of some bones and flesh and nerves, no different from a monkey, picks up a physical object, moves it through space and puts it down somewhere else. That's all there is to it. But that's the last thing you see. What you see and what you perceive is that this is an act of generosity. What you perceive is somebody who loves you. You follow me? You perceive their personality. That's what you relate to. And if you think about it, you never saw it at all. You never see anybody's personality. You never see a neshama. You never ever see another human being. Isn't that remarkable? No matter how intimately you might live with someone, for all of your life, you'll never ever begin to see them. All you'll ever see is the end of their nose, the skin that encases them. Is that correct? You'll never see the person, but it doesn't bother you at all. Because this crude and lowly casing that they walk around in, this is what the mystics call it, the garment, this garment of flesh, is a perfectly adequate that when it's used, you immediately understand what it means inwardly. You can never explain it. You follow? You don't have to float around in the meditational world, in the mystical world. You have it right there. If only you know to understand it, if only you know what that switch is that's happening every time you listen to a person. When a person speaks to you and inspires you, you don't hear somebody who inspires you. You have somebody close to you and everything they say inspires you. It's a few miserable sound waves being produced by some very, very crude and temporary tissue. That's all it is. It could have been produced by a machine. Can be reproduced exactly by a machine. If you hear it on a tape recorder, it's a machine doing it. There's a few magnetic forces moving over a piece of metal. That's all you're hearing. But that's the last thing you think about. What you experience when you hear them, you experience the person inside. Even though all that happened was some sound waves vibrating a piece of tissue in your ear. So a person has to analyze that experience. Now, using that tool, using that switch, let's understand, let's try and define the outer eye and the inner eye, and let's see if we can get a feel for what it is. So Augustus says this, alright, you with me? What we're going to do is the following exercise. We're going to look at the outer eye, we're going to try and define it, and we're going to try and understand from there that everything that it is, what we're talking about is the opposite, okay? But we can't say the opposite, because there aren't any words. In other words, the system is going to be as follows. Are you with me? The system is as follows. The outer system is amenable to definition, and we can pick out its definitional points. The inner vision is the exact opposite of all those camps. Okay? So let's get clear what those lines of connection are, and then let's define the outer, and then we'll know what the inner is. The outer eye is as follows. It is the eye that sees the world. It's where you make contact with the world in every physical way. That means by touching it, by seeing it, by tasting, by smelling, by hearing. In addition, it's every place you make contact with the world through your rational mind. That means when you work out something or understand something rationally, that's also part of outer experience. It's not part of inner experience. And the obvious test of it is that a machine can do that also. To work out a thing rationally, that 1 and 1 is 2, you don't have to be human. A machine can do that also. And therefore, it's part of the outside world. Are you with me? Now, let's listen carefully. The qualities of the outer world are, one, you can put it in words. Well, you can certainly put this in words. How you go about sensing something that you can sense with a sensory modality, how you work out what 1 and 1 is 2 is, you can put into words. Two, you can express it to somebody else and prove it to them. Certainly. You can demonstrate, you can prove, you can do an experiment. You can communicate it, you can experience it, you can test it out, you can measure it, you can prove it. Those are all the characteristics of this mode. The inner mode has all the opposite characteristics. You can't put it in words by definition. You cannot put it in words, you can't write it down, you can't do an experiment to prove it. You can never share it with anyone else. You can never convey it. That's why the only way to do this in life is to try and relate to people who know it already. And the only reason that you make a soul connection with somebody else is not because you ever convey to them what you're experiencing inwardly. The only way you ever convey it is because you have a certainty that they've experienced it themselves. That's all. And they identify with their own inner experience when they know that you're identifying with yours. But that's where you bond together. But you never can give them yours. It's a pathetic aspect of human relationships that the deep, you see, what we're talking about here is what makes you human. The outer side, a machine and a monkey can do just as well. The only place you're human is in this undefinable inner world. Is that correct? The Western world thinks exactly the opposite. The Western, and that's why there's a whole debate in the scientific world now, whether you could build a machine that would be the same as a person. But in their terms, of course you can. Because to them, what a person is what you can see that he does, and what he can figure out intellectually. So of course you can build a machine that does that. You could probably build a much better machine, that they wouldn't be about to blow itself apart like we are. That's what you could do. That's why they have this whole debate. But that's not what makes you human. What makes you human is only the inner area. It's only the area that can't be put into words and can't be defined. It's only that hidden world that makes you human. So there's nothing more important than this. One of the pathetic aspects of human relationships is that one of the deepest needs we have is to use that. And one of the most potent expressions of that is connecting with someone else. And one of the most potent ways of connecting with someone else is to share your das with them. And you can never do it. So the frustration always is, I'll give you an example. You have an inspiring experience in life. Let's say you happen to be traveling on a road someplace and you come across an amazing, inspiring scene. You know what your first emotion is? You wish you could share this with somebody's friend. And you have a burning desire to do that. And not only that, but you can't enjoy it because of that. And actually, you don't experience it because you can't share it. You ever had that experience? And it can be such a heavy pain that it's inexpressible. Because the das is such a need to function that you need to translate it into that point of connection. People who reach a level of spiritual self-sufficiency, they never experience that because their own das is so alive and so rich that they make a connection with themselves all the time. People like that are never bored. People like that are never bored. Because they always have the most intrinsic and intimate experience of life, right? In and of themselves. In and of themselves. That means they never need another human being. They only can give to another human being. Somebody on that level only ever needs someone else in order to give to. But not to take from. Now, let's continue with the exercise. Let's look at the outer eye, and then let's see what it does. Rabdesna said the following comment. He said that these two forces are so opposite to each other, they're so intensely postured away from each other, that they function like this. The outer eye, he said, is like a camera. The unique thing about a camera is that it can take a picture of anything in the world except the camera. You can never turn it inward. The only way to turn it inward is to break it. If you're very clever, you could take a picture of a reflection of the camera, which is a technique that we use in the spiritual world. But leaving that aside for now, you can never get the camera, and you have to know the rules, by the way, because when you do that, right is left and left is right, and that's how the essence of spiritual awareness is. And how to translate what's up to down, down to up. It's a whole system, a whole other thing. That's what the Kabbalistic wisdom is. Just being able to look in that mirror. Exactly being able to look in that mirror. And if we get time, maybe some other time, we can try and talk about that. Now, we're not, again, please, we're not trying to express things this evening that are far distant spiritual ideas. We're trying only to say things that everybody should know intimately. I hope, if I'm successful, I believe that everything I've said up to now has not been anything new. If I'm doing my job correctly, you should just recognize everything that I'm saying. If you hear anything new that you never knew before, I'm making a mistake. Is it correct? That's what the mystics say, that the truth of Torah, when you go to the depth of the root of things, then what they always say is a MS Aid Latma. The truth is a witness to itself. It doesn't have to be proved because you experience it yourself. It just needs to be shone up and a little bit clarified so that you actually realize you knew it all along. Is that correct? That I'm not saying anything over here. You just hear it. Now, so what do you have? You have this paradox. You have a camera. The camera can take a picture of anything outside, but it can't be used to take a picture. So it leaves you in the following agonizing situation. Everything that you know with the inner mind, and it's the most important thing, and it's what makes you human, and it's what makes you you, can never be understood with a camera. But all you have at your disposal is the camera. So what you keep trying to do is turn the camera in. And every time you turn it in, it breaks. Is that correct? Whenever you want to know about Hashem, or about many other things that you apprehend only with the Das, what happens is, you start trying to think about it. And how do you think? In words. In words, in pictures, in images, in proofs, in experiments, all kinds of things. And as soon as you do that, you smash it. So you never get anywhere. Is that correct? That's exactly what happens. The only way to get into the subject is to stop thinking about it. You have to know it because you know it. You know how most of us think? You know how pathetic it is? The way we think is like this. Never mind knowing it spiritually. The way we think is like this. We actually, you might laugh in embarrassment, but we actually have secretly a dialogue with ourselves. That's our schizophrenic we are. We say something, yes, as if we're saying it to somebody else. Some people, actually see their lips move. And then you quickly run around and you listen to what it sounds like, and you're ready, and it becomes, is that correct? And then you make an answer. And in fact, you get so tangled up in it, so pathetic at this, that while you're actually saying it, you're already thinking what you're going to answer. You're already thinking why it's not right and what you're going to answer. That'll give yourself a chance to speak. Is that correct? We never raise our thoughts, right? We never raise our thoughts, except on very, very rare occasions, into the realm where you're not thinking in words and pictures and images and so forth, right? That's what it is. I want to tell you, as an aside, because it's linked to the subject, but because it's just about as important as the subject, that one of the modalities of this generation that people are glued to, I'm not going to debase this lecture with even mentioning the modality, but there's a form of, if you'll permit the expression, entertainment, I don't know what you want to call it, that people utilize. They not only prepare you, they even take it into their homes, and they prepare to glue it. You follow more or less what I'm talking about. They glue themselves to this modality, which presents things in pictures. The Gedolim say about it, the Torah objection to it, you should know clearly, the Torah objection to this thing is not, the Torah objection to this thing is not because what they show you is forbidden to look at. It's not the main problem. It's bad enough, I can assure you. What they show you, most of it forbidden for a person to look at, right? In terms of immodesty, in terms of brutality, in terms of things that a Jew is not allowed to look at. That's enough reason for it to be forbidden. But there's a much deeper problem. A much deeper problem. One of the greatest people I ever met, who happens to be one of the world's authorities on education of young children, once said to me that the main problem with this thing is that it leaves nothing for the Das to do. It presents you such a ready-made picture. The methodology, the modality that comes across is so strongly worked out that it leaves nothing for the mind to do. It totally paralyzes and inactivates a developing mind. Let's understand that. Not just because the quality of what they show is pathetically low. That's not the problem. And I'm not saying it couldn't be modified in such a way, but it could be used in a productive way. It could be used as a stimulating modality. Somewhere when Mashiach comes, that's what they'll use it for. They'll use it for something. They're not going to be wasted. There are other uses for it. So Rabbi Gemilla says one of the best uses for it is to kick out the glass and use it for a case for your Gemara. The mystics use humor to try and. But what we're saying is very deep. that when you have that method, when you read, reading is a kosher modality. Because when you read, what happens is your das builds up what's happening. You couldn't make it more explicit than seeing it the way you do. Even if they fed in sound and touch, it wouldn't make much difference. It's virtually there already. Because those are such, when you feed those in through the imagination, it hardly adds anything. The das doesn't have to work. When you read, your inner being works all the time. And it's a kosher modality. You're actually translating everything through the filter of the das. But when you see it like that, you're like, no. If you want to have human children, then you can't have that thing. Right? If you want children, they're going to turn out to be human. Again, if you want reptiles, right? If you want mutated reptiles for children, then that's easy. Because those things don't have das. That's easy to bring up. But if you want human children, it's hard enough in this generation with the perfect environment to turn out a child that's halfway human. Now, the next step. The next step is like this. That when you turn the camera in, you have the paradox. So now let's try and understand. The only way to approach the subject at the next level is as follows. Since we can't say what the das is, all what we can do this. We can take the areas that the das grasps, right? Those we can deal with. Those are clear. We can express which areas and subjects it is that this inner wisdom can deal with. And then we can try and understand how we know those things. You'll find that these are the most important things in life. When I list for you what are these areas, you'll see that there's nothing more important in life. They are the areas that make you human, and they're the areas that make life meaningful. Everything else is just a sensation of the senses, or it's a computational faculty that a machine can do, which isn't life at all. And you'll see remarkably and amazingly that each and every one of these areas, you only know with the das, and you'll see that you know them. You'll see that they're paradoxical, they completely contradict the external wisdom, and yet you know them, although they contradict rational knowledge and you can't explain them. Every one of these totally confounds and contradicts rational knowledge, and yet you know it intimately, don't have any problem. That's because your das is functional. But as soon as you start thinking about these things and trying to understand them, which means rationalize and put them in words and prove them, then immediately you think you're a fool to have thought those things. And a minute later, when you relax and stop thinking about it, you know them again. There are many crude experiments that you can do to show this thing. Somebody once used the following crude experiment to show that there are things that you know because you know them, and even when you think about them, they turn out to be otherwise. Because you know them, it's adequate to convince you that they're true. The example is very crude, because it's an example of something that you happen to know because you've actually experienced it. Actually, that's the deepest form of that. The deepest form of that is where the marriage has actually taken place. Right? It's not just an engagement. Right? That means you've actually experienced it intimately already. So you know it's true. But nevertheless, the example will suffice as an introduction. An example is this, that there are many things that mathematicians can prove to you that are absurdities. And yet they're not absurd. But the only place you can grasp that they're not absurd is with a das. Usually they go around the concept of infinitesimals and infinity. And I'll give you a crude example. A crude example is that it's possible to prove mathematically that it's impossible to walk from here through that door. It's possible to prove mathematically. Why? Because, very simply, to walk from here to there, you have to walk halfway first. Is that correct? To walk halfway, you have to walk halfway of that first. Is that correct? To walk to that point, you've first got to walk halfway there. You wouldn't disagree with me, right? To get to that point, you have to walk, and stop, and it doesn't never ends. Which means that there's an infinity of points you have to walk through before you can get any place. And everybody knows that to walk through an infinity of points will take you an infinite amount of time. That's correct? I know there's a powerful mathematician sitting here this evening. I might be wrong about the mathematics, but that's the way it's been expressed to me. Well, even if I'm wrong about the mathematics, it serves to illustrate the point. You can correct me with pleasure. But, even if you think about this, it will not send you into a state of shock and panic about how you're going to get out of here tonight. Because your das tells you, you've got a healthy sense of experience that it can be done. You follow? The das overrides the rational faculty. Except when you start thinking about it. If you think about it powerfully enough, you'll think that you can't get through that door. But as soon as you stop thinking and know, then you know it can be done. Das is what you know because you know it. Now let's take a list. Let's take the areas that you know because you know them. Are you with me? And let's examine how it is impossible to apprehend them with the outer knowledge, and when you try, they crash. I'll first give you a simple example. Rav Dessler, one of Rav Dessler's most famous Talmidim, that's Rav Mordechai Miller from Gateshead, he learned this from his great Rebbe Rav Dessler. And when he used to explain the subject, when he gives the following example. It's a very beautiful example, because many people have experienced this. He tries to give an example of the clash between the inner and outer wisdoms, and how they conflict with each other. And he gives the following example. He says this. He says, when he was a little boy, he used to lie on his back on the grass and look up at the sky. Then he used to say to himself, where does it end? Then he used to say to himself, of course it doesn't end. Then a minute later he'll say, so what are you talking about? It's got to end someplace. Nothing can go on forever. I mean, if you go far enough, there's got to be an end. Then he'd say, oh, there's an end. Then a minute later he'd say, but 1 second, what's beyond that? Well, there must be a bit more space beyond that. Then he'd say, and then beyond that also. Oh, so then it doesn't end. And then he'd say, but 1 second, that's impossible. And have you ever experienced that? You have a rapid oscillation between two impossible concepts. What's happening over there is that the das is coming into conflict with the rational world. Because the das is perfectly comfortable with infinity. It isn't a problem. The concept of infinity lives in the das with no problem at all. But the rational mind can't handle that, because the rational mind is only that which can apprehend, that which can be measured and proven and put into boundaries and borders and that. So the rational, you follow what's happening. So as soon as you know it, it isn't a problem. But then when you start thinking about it, the camera breaks down, and then you throw out one or the other. The Western world, you know what's happened. The Eastern world has thrown out the rational. The Eastern world overrides the rational with inner knowledge. It doesn't have any problem with the conflict from the rational. Right? Because it says that Avraham Avinu, Abraham, sent the mystical knowledge to the East. That was the special gift that he sent them. He sent six or seven of his children, six particular children to the East, with fragments of Hashem's Hebrew name that formed the mantras that they use. And from that came the whole of Eastern spiritual thinking. Now, that is directly Kabbalistic, and it can be traced in detail. And if we have some other time, on another occasion, we can try. It's a difficult exercise, because a lot of what they believe and talk about is impure from a Jewish point of view, and therefore it's forbidden to talk about in detail. But with care, one can do that exercise another time. The West has thrown away inner wisdom. The West, leading on from the Greek times, deals only with what you can see and measure and prove and experiment on. And if you can't do an experiment to show it, and you can't measure it, Western wisdom says that it's unreal. I can't deal with it. I don't have the tools to measure it, and therefore I'm going to explain the world without it. And the Torah objection to that is that it's not that it's not spiritual, it's not scientific. That's the Torah objection to Western thinking. We don't mind, we understand that they don't have a Torah basis, that doesn't bother us. What we object to so strongly is that it's not honest, it's not scientific. Because you don't have the tools to measure a thing, you're just going to cut it out of existence? Because you don't have the tools to measure something, so you're just going to claim that it doesn't exist and just chop it off? And then you're going to claim that everything you're explaining is a totality of reality? You hear what I'm saying? That's what they do. The Western world will tell you that there's a rational world that can be measured. There may be a spiritual world someplace that you religious people talk about, but since we haven't got the tools that can measure it, we can't deal with it, so we're going to assume it doesn't exist, and we're going to explain the world. But we're going to do useful experiments. That wouldn't bother us. We're going to experiment to find out how to use electricity and physics and so on. That wouldn't bother us, but that's not what they do. They say they're searching for truth. They want to explain to you the meaning of existence. That's what a scientist will tell you, they're searching for truth. Searching for truth? You just chopped the head off. You just chopped off the whole world that gives the whole essence of what gives meaning to anything, right? Because you say you can't measure it, you just deny it, and now you can explain to me what truth is. Do you follow me? That's not scientific. My Rebbe once said, it's like taking a dog, cutting his head off, and as he twitches in his death throes, you start making measurements that are going to explain to me what a dog is. So you know what you're going to come up with. You're going to come up with a dead dog. That's what he is. But then you got the audacity, but what they do, the audacity to explain that that's exactly what the world is. They don't say we're measuring from here on down, and in terms of our frame of reference, this is what we're measuring. They say they're explaining reality to you. Do you follow? What an evil, what a great evil that is. The evil is that it's not true, it's not honest in its own terms. Do you follow? That's why the real scientist is religious. The real scientist is religious, because he's prepared to accept, right, any possibility, and he's prepared to check it out. You hear? They say that the religious people are narrow-minded. But it's exactly the opposite. But they're the narrow-minded ones, because they define the borders of reality. In those borders, they tell you they're very broad-minded. That's like saying, I'm going to look here. In here, I'm very broad. That's what they're saying. But the religious thinker is the one who perfectly accepts all of the physical observations, doesn't bother him, but he's prepared to take anything else as well. Let's understand this well. Now, let's take the most important example. The most important example that the Das grasps and apprehends, and let's try and understand this. Okay, here you have to hold on tight, because this is the beginning, this is the beginning of the depth of working of the Das, and it's the beginning of Emunah. How it applies to Emunah, we certainly won't have time to go into tonight. What we're trying to establish tonight is the tool that's used for this methodology, for this task, right? In Yitzhak Hashem, in the future, we'll try and understand how the tool is used, what davening means, what's the meditation of davening, how to get up to the point for Rotson, which is over here. The Das is a line that goes through individuals, a straight line that goes through the tongue, the Bris Haloshen, through the Bris Milah, circumcision. It's a line that goes up and down. It's not a place, it's an energy. It comes out where a baby's skull is open. It's where you put your tefillin on, which gives tremendous light and shining to the Das. That's what tefillin do for you. That's what guarding the tongue does for you. It strengthens the Das. And guarding the circumcision, the Bris Milah, those things that are on the center line, all other organs are doubled. All other life-sustaining organs are doubled. They're male or female. As it happens, they're all female. But the central line, the Das, that is done only by guarding these areas. A person is married to a non-Jew. A Jew is married to a non-Jew cannot experience the Das. And it says he won't experience it in the next world either. Says that even a person who once had a relationship with a non-Jew, before you panic, you have to know that it's in proportion to the degree of responsibility. That means if you didn't know it at the time, then it doesn't have this effect. But you know it now. it's beneath the level of this lecture to have to say that it's not because there's anything wrong with non-Jews, understand that. But it's because there's two different wavelengths, different tunings, and the non-Jewish world has a totally different job to do on it, and they can connect to their own Das in that way. Right? It's just... We have to talk about that next time. Now, the most important area that the Das deals with is the knowledge that I exist. The knowledge that I am, you only know with the Das. You do not know it because of any rational faculty. And that's the most important thing a person can ever understand. How do I know that I exist? I know it because I know it. Right? If you don't know that, you don't have Das. If you know that you exist because you just know it, then your Das is functioning. And don't think about it. If you think about it, you'll lose it. If you start thinking about whether I do exist or not, definitely you'll lose it. But that's not because you don't have Das, that's just because you're thinking about it. But before you start thinking about it, the fact that you know that you are is the normal functioning of the Das. Why at the beginning of Emunah, which is what we can't discuss in detail, is because one of the secret names, one of the mystical names, be very, very careful with this idea. I'm going to tell you a very, very deep mystical secret that is sure to be misunderstood. One of the deepest secret names of Hashem is I. The word Ani. The word Ani in Hebrew, which means I, is one of the deepest of Hashem's mystical names. Be very, very careful with that idea. It means Ani, it doesn't mean you. It means Ani. Hillel, when Hillel came to the Beis HaMikdash, when Hillel came to the rejoicing of Sukkot, he said, "Im ani kan, hakol kan. If I'm here, everything's here." And he was the humblest man who ever lived. He didn't mean if I am here, everything's here. He meant if the Ani of the world is here. And he could say it because he was that humble. But the depth of that secret is that if a person knows what I am, if you know what it means to exist because you know it, then you could begin to know that there's something that's outside of you, and you know it in the same way. And that's the first step towards inner grasp of Emunah. Let's try and work it out together a little bit more deeply. The reason that you know that you are, that if you think you know where you exist because you can see yourself, or taste, or touch, or feel, it's a very, very lonely misconception. If you could imagine yourself being blotted out from all sensory modalities, imagine yourself being put in an environment where you couldn't see, taste, touch, feel, imagine such a thing. You would still know that you exist. You do not have to pinch yourself to know that you exist. You have within you, you carry within you, a deep inner consciousness of the fact that you are. If you've got doubts about it, it's a serious problem. The mystics say that the first thing that the mind grasps is its own existence. That means whenever you want to grasp anything in the world, the first thing that the mind has to do before it can grasp anything is the fact that it is. Before you can grasp anything, even in the rational world, you first have to be aware that you are. Is that clear? Actually, in the mystical writings, it says that there is one other thing that comes before it, and I'm not going to go into detail, and that is the fact that before you are aware that you are aware of the consciousness that you are. Okay? The first tenth of the ten, the first tenth of the first one, of the first 10 points of knowledge, is that before you know that you are, you know that you're aware that you are. You know that you know it, in other words. But it's enough, I promise you, just to get into touch with the fact that you know that you are, for no other reason. You're healthy psychologically and mentally, so you know that. If you could get into the fact that you actually happen to know it as well, so then you're on the first step to spiritual greatness. But if you want to know if you're healthy, mentally, then you have to know that you exist. And you have to know it because you know it. If you have any questions about it, you have to see someone from another profession. They say that there was, you know, the oldest problem in philosophy, and you're probably aware, and after tonight's discussion it should be blindingly clear why this is. The oldest problem in philosophy is proving whether I am or not. Is that correct? The oldest, most classical problem in philosophy is, can you prove that I am? And there have been brilliant attempts and failures, brilliant failures, no successes, in trying to prove philosophically that I am. Descartes' famous statement, I think, therefore I am, we'll have to explain. But before I get to that, why is it that philosophers try? I mean, it's pathetic, isn't it? The most important thing in the world is whether you are or not, right? Nothing begins. If you're going to debate the meaning of the cosmic, of cosmology and cosmogony and the meaning of science and the world and so forth, then you're in doubt about whether you're here. It's a little pathetic, that. So before you're going to debate anything philosophical or meaningful, you first have to know that you're around. But if you think you're a figment of your own imagination, or somebody else's, or whatever these other theories are, so then it's a little pathetic to start discussing the meaning of life. And the embarrassing side is that Western philosophy has never been able to prove that you are in the first place. But that's a little bit embarrassing. But after tonight's discussion, it should be painfully obvious why. Because the only place you can ever know that you are is in the place that knows a thing because you know it. And all Western rationalization is trying to do is prove a thing in outer terms. But it can never grasp the inner reality. Is that correct? So they'll make experiments and thought experiments and rationalizations and computer whatever you want to do is taking the camera, they're trying to turn it inwards, and the more they contort that camera, the more it breaks down. Is that correct? It's so obvious. And the frustration they have is because when they burn their brains out, that's what happens to a scientist. When he starts to prove, does he exist or doesn't he? This is what happens to a philosopher. He thinks and thinks and thinks and thinks and finally blows a fuse. And in that moment when he sits back exhausted, he knows that he is. And then he wakes up and he knows the truth. Then he starts to think how he knows it. That's exactly how it is. That's exactly what happens. Is that correct? That's why the Gaon of Vilna, the Gaon says that the most powerful time of the day is when you're sleeping. Because when you're sleeping, you can't use the rational faculty. So you know things, and that's why dreams have a certain reality. And of course, that's why marriage and the night time are all connected, and what midnight means, and whatever. And it's difficult to go into the details, but that's the time of connection. And that's why a person could reach further in a dream. I'll give you an example. The same faculty that knows that I am is the faculty that knows anything because you know it. When you know that 101 is 2, listen well. When you know that 101 is 2, you actually know it in two different ways. You know it rationally like a machine, but you also know that it's true. Is that correct? The Mishnah says, Im ein bina, ein das. Im ein das, ein bina. If you don't have rational outer knowledge, you can't have inner knowledge. You can't have one without the other. But if you don't have inner knowledge, you don't have anything meaningful in the outer world, because it's naked figures, like you're a machine. Now, which means that everything you know, you actually know like a machine, but then you also know that it's true because you know it's true, and that you could never explain. Sometimes you have the brilliant experience where the two separate. And in the moment that they separate, you actually know what das is. And I'll give you a perfect example. What I'm going to do now, I'm going to go through one or two exercises that flex the muscles of the das. Again, there are things that you've experienced. But if you suddenly crystallize for yourself that that's what it was, so immediately you'll be flooded with an understanding of what the das is. Are you with me? Let's go. Sometimes, a person, again, what are we striving for? We want to understand that there's something you know intellectually, but then there's a deeper knowledge that's the bonding with that outer knowledge, that inner knowledge is the das. Okay, it's like an understanding of the thing. I'll give you an example. Sometimes you work on a problem. and you work on that problem for hours, right? Let's say it's a Gemara, or maybe mathematics, or science, or whatever it is. And you work on, you've got a textbook in front of you, or a black Gemara, and you work on the problem. And you spend 8 hours in a row working on the problem. Until you're so conversant with it, you've got the problem and the answer, right? The answer, the question and the answer is all in front of you in this text. What happens? You work on it until you've got it so clear that you can repeat it backwards, forwards, sideways, you've got, you know it off by heart. Is that correct? But you don't understand what it means. Ever had that experience? You just don't understand, can't grasp it. But it says to you from beginning to end, and the steps make perfect sense, and one goes to two, and you understand it, and two goes to three anyway, but by the time you get to step 10, you know it must be right, because it says so, and because it all checks out, but you don't understand what it means. Have you had that experience? What happens? You go to sleep. Go to sleep. You wake up the next morning, and you suddenly understand what it means. Had that experience? You suddenly understand. So of course what happens is usually you say, I worked it out. But you didn't work anything out, you were sleeping. Right? You got such an inflated ego that when it's given to you as a gift, you say you worked it out. But if you didn't work it out, it was given to you as a gift when you stopped thinking about it. The problem is you were thinking about it so much that you couldn't understand it. Is that correct? That's why the Das is the experience of totality. You had all the parts, and you had the connections, but you didn't have the totality. It's that hidden element, it's what Mystics call Shabbos. It's the time when everything comes together without being anything new. It isn't anything new. Shabbos isn't another thing. Shabbos don't float around. Shabbos a day. But it's the time when everything suddenly connects. The mystics say, it's like, if you want to put it in graphic terms, it's like when you take the six sides of a cube and you put them together, you actually have seven things. You have six things, but then you have the fact that they're all connected and they make one thing. Actually, you can't do that thing. If I ask you to take out that thing and show it to me, as soon as you try and take it out, everything collapses. You can only show it to me, you follow me, when everything else is there. Only when the rational is working correctly does the bias flourish inside it. You can't have one without the other. It's a very, very deep thing. That's why you have to strengthen the intellectual and the rational. You have to be able to think straight in order to have bias, even though bias isn't thinking. If you can't think straight externally, you can't have bias inwardly. And that's what Gemara does. Anybody who strengthens his mind in Gemara. Women can have bias. Women can have a very strong bias of Chibur, and that's why women don't study Gemara, because it weakens a certain faculty. That's why it's traditional for women not to study Gemara. Because it will weaken a certain faculty that they have a gift in. Women should study the more mystical ones, where the Das alone offers. That's what women should study. And they should study the depth of character and personality development, where they have a talent, and many other things. But when a man studies Gemara, the first thing that he's trained in is rational, rigorous, rigorous critical thinking. Because as he strengthens the external frame of the mind, the Das starts coming together inside. And the Gemara is so craftily arranged that it challenges the Das to be developed. Even though it doesn't say that directly, but it challenges the Das to come out. Now, that difference between knowing a thing rationally and understanding it, that's how you know that you are. That's how you know that you exist. When you think about it rationally, it breaks down. It reminds me, they say there was once in university, a very high-level university class, the professor was explaining to the students that philosophically you can't know whether you exist or not. So he gave this whole lecture, right from a rational philosophical Western point of view, that actually there are no proofs that you exist. And one of the students got very worried. So after the class he was terribly distraught, and he spent a week in agony. He spent a week agonizing about whether he is or isn't. Right? He had real problems with it. He was a very powerful intellectual, and he... At the end of the week, he couldn't stand it anymore. So he went to see the professor, and he ran up to him and he said, Professor, you've just got to tell me, do I exist or don't I? So the professor said to him, who wishes to know? Now, let's take one or two experiments that you can do within the Das to experience its reality. Okay? Now, as follows. Let's understand. The core of the Das, again, the core of the Das is the fact that I know that I am. And if you check it out, you'll see it fits all the criteria. You can never express it to somebody else. You prove to somebody else that you know you exist. I don't mean prove to somebody else that you exist. That they can measure rationally. They can touch, taste, feel, okay? But you express to them, try and prove to them your knowledge that you exist, can't do it. Never express it, never write it down, never prove it, cannot be proved. And therefore, it's not amenable to scientific, do not speak to a scientist about it. Because you want rational proof, and what it's asking you to do is break down the camera. So you can't do that. You can only speak to a scientist who knows it already himself because he knows it. Now, what experiments can you do in your own consciousness that bring out the experience of the Das. So they give two exercises, and I'll just take a minute's thought, and you can experience it yourself. They say that a time when the Das raises its head, in other words, when the Das comes in, a time when you are totally flooded with a consciousness of your own existence, is a moment of absolute abject terror. When you have an experience of total, abject, blistering fear, in that moment you are totally clear that you exist. Is that correct? Have you ever been in an experience where the plane starts to shake badly? Huh? So the experience you have in such a situation is this. You're busy traveling, you're out, you've got a transatlantic flight, there's 35,000 people, are you? And you're thinking about everything that's important in life. What you're going to do when you get there, and this and that, and these details. And now there are a whole thing that's very important in life. And worries and worries and worries. Suddenly the plane starts to shake very badly, and you start the wings start to bend. And suddenly, instantaneously, they just aren't important anymore. Suddenly the whole world of external energy dissolves, and the only thing that exists is, please don't let me die, or my child. That's all. And that moment, try next time that happens. Let me give you another next time that happens to you, why don't you try the following approach? Say to yourself, well, look, last night, the plane's shaking badly and you're terrified. Listen, one second. Last night I was sitting back in my armchair, rationalizing about whether I do or don't exist. So for the next few minutes, let's take the line that I don't exist and solve all the problems. Try doing that when you're expected. Because rationally, it's possible that you do or you don't. So let's just assume that I don't for now. You'll find it's impossible. What fear does is it smashes the rational part of the brain. Abject fear smashes the rational part of the mind, and it leaves only the Das. The problem with this experiment is you have to separate out the emotion. Das is not an emotion. Das is not fear. Das is a clear knowledge that you exist. We're not talking about fear over here. Are you with me? Don't get confused with emotion. Unfortunately, there aren't other exercises, so you can't walk around and just experience the Das. Actually, you can. Actually, you can, but that you just have to do. But if you want an experience, an experiment that sharpens it up, then this is an experience. But draw out of it the fear and see what you're left with. They say another example, and another example is, actually, in depth, it's more powerful, and it's this. When you've been in a situation where you were about to die, and death was going to be in the next second, that means you stood on the face of death, and the next second you were about to die, and then you don't die. If you ever sucked under the waves and you can't take a breath, has it ever happened? You sucked under by a powerful undercurrent and you can't get up and you have no more breath. And you're aware that one more second, in that instant, as your consciousness slips, you break a surface and you take a breath. That first breath is a breath of pure Das. In that instant, you know that you're alive. Actually, it's the greatest happiness that there can be. Actually, it's more ecstatic than any other experience in life. In the mystical writings it says that all other ecstasies, all other happinesses, are just tiny whiffs of that emotion of being alive. The only thing is, you're built in such a way that it takes an experience that almost kills you before you actually have a simple feeling that you're alive. That's all. When you come up from those waves and you realize you're alive, what are you so happy about? What's the big deal? You were alive like this 5 minutes ago also, and you weren't just singing with ecstasy. You were enjoying a normal holiday by the sea, right? That's all that was going through your mind. Right now, all that happened, right, is that you're alive. That's all. In fact, you're not so good as you were. You're gasping and you're a bit blue. And you're going on with all kind of poetic expressions of ecstasy right now. Why? But all you're experiencing is just being alive. Actually, that is the greatest ecstasy in the world. Just being conscious. But the problem is, we're so dull. We're so pathetically dull that after you experience it for 1 second, you forget about it completely. And it leaves you completely. The only person who's happy, if a person goes to see his doctor with a fatal illness, right? A lethal illness, and he's on his last lap, and he staggers in to the doctor, and he knows he's got minutes left. The doctor examines him and tells him, I can't believe it, you're cured. How does that person walk home? Leaps over the building, sails over the trees. Is that correct? What's going on? He's just alive. That's all. That's just alive. But you know why it feels that way? Because he was about not to be. That's all. That's all. So actually, by rights, when you wake up in the morning, you should be more happy than that. Here's a person who's just been through a harrowing experience, and he's probably still quite weak, and he's probably, he's been through quite a shock, this person, and he's singing with ecstasy. So you wake up in the morning and you're feeling fine? Well, you should be ecstatic. That's what the Bali Musa say. But we don't understand what it means to be alive, because our Das isn't functioning. If you walked around with a healthy Das, you wouldn't be worried about anything. The only reason you worry in life, this is not Musa tonight. I'm not going into Musa, but I can't help putting this in. The only reason you worry about things is you can think about them. If you had healthy, clear diet, it would so override the... I'm not saying you wouldn't worry. And I'm not saying you wouldn't think about things, and you have to, it's an obligation. But the ecstasy of being alive would be so powerful that you'd easily deal with the problems. First of all, many of them would never crop up. Most of the ridiculous things that you get into in life are completely unnecessary in the beginning. Most failed relationships, for example. Well, because the relationship was started on such a nonsensical... There were such skews and problems in the relationship that it was such nonsense in the first place. That there's such focuses on things that aren't life itself in the first place. Correct? A healthy diet is the first thing you need to be normal. Alright. It's late and I don't want to continue too much longer. I just want to say that the things that the diet understands that it grapples with are, first and foremost, the experience of being alive. That's all. Just knowing that you're here. And for the next 2 minutes, if you'll permit me, with your permission, in an extra couple of minutes, longer than usual, just to complete the subject, I just want to tell you a few more areas, briefly, very briefly. Have your permission? A few more areas that the diocese grapples with and grasps, and the only tool and the only access, the only avenue to these areas is this knowledge. Nothing else will do it. And very briefly, they are as follows. One, the concept of the present. You'll notice, of course, that all the things we discussed, and nothing could be more important than them, right? Nothing could be more important than the fact that I am. Right? And what it means in terms of happiness. The fact, I did promise to mention Descartes, and I'll just mention it briefly. When Descartes says, I think, therefore I am, 2 minutes of rational thought will show you that he doesn't mean that because my brain cerebrates, that means because I have electrochemical thought activity going on in my brain, that is no proof that I exist. Descartes knew that. You follow? Are you with me? I think, therefore I am, does not mean, because thinking, do you know what thinking is? Thinking is a physiological process just like any other. When you think, what happens is you have a certain amount of electrochemical activity that's taking place in the brain. A very low amount of energy, but it's there. When that happens, it is no more proof that you're alive than when a muscle twitches or a bladder contracts. Those are also physiological processes, and they certainly don't prove that you're alive, that you're here. Descartes, are you with me? Descartes did not, he did not mean, at least we give him credit for that. Well, at least we give him credit. Now, for that level, what he meant was, I know that I am, that's why I am. That's what he means, I think. Do you follow? He doesn't mean I celebrate like a machine. That isn't proof that I am. That's the problem, not the proof. You with me? What he meant was, I experience the fact that I am. That's how I know that I am. But he can't put that into words except for initiate. So he puts a statement that's very concise that the one who understands will understand what he means. Like all deeper knowledge. It's only when you already understand it you know what's being spoken about. Are you with me? But when you look at it nakedly, I think therefore I am. No, are you convinced? Did it prove it to you? Did it prove it to any philosopher? Did he walk away happy now? Was there ever a philosopher who was wondering about whether he was? He opened the reason, I think therefore I am. Oh, now he knows he exists. It's obvious, no? The next area that the diocese grasps is the awareness of the present. Because mathematically, there is no concept of the present. In physics and in mathematics, there is no concept of now. Because the definition in physics and science and mathematics of now is the infinitesimally thin interface. Infinitesimally thin means that it's too thin to be apprehended. That means it isn't here. It's the infinitely thin interface between the past and the future. And the past isn't here for sure. Right? Where's the past now? At best, it's a few wisps of memory, maybe, right? And even those are not so reliable. So the past isn't here for sure. And where's the future? That for sure is not here. So now where are you? So where are you? One second, where do you live? In the present or the past or the future? Where do you actually live? Don't think about it. Know it. Now, right? When are you alive? Yesterday. Are you alive tomorrow? You're alive now, right? You know what's fascinating? All the women are nodding and all sitting blankly. Is that right? A man will not allow himself to be drawn into the dust. He won't allow that. Unless he's figured it out, he won't go there. Is that correct? You belong there. Again. Stay with me. You've been, huh? Again, rationally. Again. rationally, whatever you like. When do you live? You live now. Okay? What you experience is the present. But the present isn't here. In fact, in mathematics, there is a special notation. Do you know that? In physics, there's a special notation they've come up with to admit their inability to do this. It's an integral, a differential, right? Which is a wavy line. That's what it is. It's a long S. A long squiggle is what it is, with a little notation, which means that it's the infinitesimal between what isn't and what isn't. And this isn't either. I'm serious about it. That's what it is. It's a concept. So in rational terms, you aren't here. But the Christ doesn't have any problems. You know what the present is? The present, I can't explain it to you. I can't put it into mathematical terms. I have to get tangled up in infinities. Okay, fine, but the Christ knows it. And what could be more important than that? Actually, the mystics take this much further. We don't have time for it now. The mystics take it much further, that the reason that life is built that way. It's a nice observation. What we've noted now is an observation, that the knowledge of the present lives in the Christ. The question is, why? The answer is, because the meaningful things in life are only living in the Christ. And there's nothing more meaningful than the fact that now isn't here. The message that you can't miss in the fact that now is ungraspable rationally is the fact that you're soon not going to be here. That's what it means. It means that all you have is an infinitesimal that slips away so fast that you can never get a hold of it. The whole experience of everything you've done in life is just a few wisps of memory. And I promise you, when you're 120 years old, it doesn't seem any more. On the contrary, it seems less. It goes quicker. So that doesn't stimulate you to achieve something. The only thing that's real is what you've produced. The change, the differential between what you were and what you are now, that remains. Right? When you use those infinitesimal milliseconds, less than that, to change all the time. So then you build something that's real. That remains. But if you try and stick it into the present, it's a tragedy. Anybody who tries to experience happiness in the physical world, it's a tragedy from beginning to end. The sharper the ecstasy, the sooner it's over. And the deeper the pain, because you realize you can't hold on to it. Anybody who's sensitive to life, but I'm saying that, only a horse would chase the kind of ecstasy that he thinks he can keep following and following. But anybody with any sensitivity knows that the more you chase it, the more sensitive you become, the more you realize that you never catch up. And finally, the next subject that the Dars grasps, it's not the last one, but the last one we'll mention now, is the concept of choice, of making a choice, of Bahira. The definition of being human is the fact that you make a choice. That's called Rotsin. You exercise a desire. You have a desire that's there for no reason other than the Dars has it. Not for any rational reason, but because it's the function of the Dars. You want it because you want it. It's the core and the source of what you are. And the Dars grasps your desire and makes a choice based on that desire. And it means that there's no rational explanation for why you want something. We started the discussion on this evening, and we're going to finish with this. When you choose Emunah, when you choose Hashem, when you choose a pathway of growth, of working on yourself, of development, of linking into a higher existence, you have to choose it because it's you, and because the Dars wants it, and because you grasp it intrinsically. But it has to be that way, because if it's rational, it's not you. If you live in a rational world, you're a machine. A machine can compute the rational conclusions. The only way to be human is to grasp something that can't be grasped rationally. That's the paradox. You have to leap in order to experience it. You'll never get there unless you leap in, and you have to leap in without proof. But once you leap in, it's clear. Once you've leapt in, then it's all there. Once you've really leapt in for no other motivation than the fact that you leapt in, then you'll feel fear on Yom Kippur. Then when you start to do something wrong and say something wrong about somebody, then you'll feel a panic. And you won't be able not to. Because when it's yours as part of your life, which is what the Dars is, but then you can't escape it. If you think for a moment, just check it out rationally, you'll see it fits all the criteria of the Dars. When you make a decision, we'll finish with this, when you make a decision based on the Dars, you know you have to do something. You know it's right. Why? I don't know. I know I have to do this. It's moral and it's correct. What's morals? What's morals? According to them, you're just an accidental gorilla. Right? You mutated over a few million years from a gorilla. A gorilla doesn't have right and wrong. It just has functional, that's all. There's no right and wrong by a gorilla, that's correct. When one animal kills another, it's not right or wrong, it's neutral. It's a biological phenomenon. So you evolved from a gorilla. A gorilla doesn't have right or wrong. So a few million years aren't going to bring that into existence. You can't evolve an absolute value. Is that correct? But you know it's right. So the scientists will laugh at you. What do you mean making a decision that's moral and right? You poor fool. You just think that way because survival-wise, you accidentally happen to evolve a mechanism that thinks right and wrong because it will help you survive. That's all. But you know it's right. You go prove to him that it's wrong to steal, or to do something else that you shouldn't. You go prove it to a rational scientist. The more you prove it, the more convulsive laughter will become. Because what he's watching is a gorilla that's going through an evolutionary process of trying to justify that it thinks it's thinking, because that must have... You realize what... And you never prove it to him. But you know you're right. You know that this is right and that's wrong. You'll never be able to prove it. Is that correct? And when you make a decision based on morality, when you make a meaningful life decision, you know you made a decision. And you know that that changed you and it changed the world. And you know that. Try to prove it to him. The usual thing, I'll give an example. Give an example. Let's make it crude and graphic. Here you have a difficult decision to make. So you agonize over the decision, right? You have a big, major life decision to make. A moral decision. You have your lower self that draws you one direction. You have a higher, more noble self. And you're struggling between the two. Finally, after sweating and shaking and agonizing for half an hour, you make a decision. And you're happy and you know it's right. Now you meet a friend of yours who's a rational scientist. So you're telling him, you know what happened today? I spent half an hour with a difficult decision and I made a decision. I made that decision, it was an expression of my essence. I really rose, I raised myself to a new level, and with all my being I made a decision and that's what I am. So he got a smirk on his face and he says to you, you poor fool. All you are is a bit of biological protoplasm, that's all you are. You evolved accidentally from a worm, and at some stage you were a gorilla, and all you did was act out your genes and your environment, that's all. Your biological tissue, all your genetic material, right? All that you are, led you to make that decision. In fact, if I would know all your genetic makeup and all the experiences you've ever been through in life, I would have been able to predict exactly what you decided. And not only that, I would have been able to predict that it would have taken half an hour of agonizing first. Right? Why? Because all you are is subject to the rules of the world. You're subject to the rules of physics. There's no higher dimension. You follow me? Now you prove him wrong. The more you try and rationalize, the more you try and convey it to him, the more he'll explain to you that you're acting out the same genes and the same molecules and the same thing that... But you know. And the conclusion that you have to take home is that the diocese is where you live. Okay? The diocese is where you live. The Western world teaches you that where you live is where your sense organs are. That's what the Western world tells you. Your sense organs, and if you want to really be a highly evolved human, then it's where your rational faculties are. If you can do sharp mathematics... Okay? That when you're really human, you're really alive. But any sensible Jew, any sensible human being knows that that's nonsense. It doesn't make you human. That it doesn't work on you, it doesn't help you work on yourself. But it's nice to be able to do all that, but it doesn't make any difference. What makes a difference is what you are inwardly. What you are inwardly, you are because you are. And you have to grasp it and apprehend it and come to grips with it. You have to know it because you know it.